morning. In Hawaii, we talk about what will happen when climate change alters our shoreline. In Alaska, it's already happening. In advance of this week's Hawaii Symposium on Climate Displacement, Migration, and Relocation, we talk with Robin Bronin of the Alaska Institute for Justice. And can business ethics be the foundation for peace in the 21st century? The head of the Zhou Enlai Peace Institute says yes. Xiaofeng Zhou North joins us later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Singer and multimedia artist Willow Chang samples the different moods of the holidays in her upcoming Doris Duke Theater show. And the Queen Emma Summer Palace gets decked out for the holidays in a rare evening celebration.
That's the conversation for this Monday, December 12th. It all starts after these headlines. Good morning and welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. And to my right, as always, my dear companion.
Good
Chris
morning,
Vandercook.
Beth
Good morning.
This new conference coming up comes in a climate change denial, doesn't it?
Well, and where it may go from this point forward,
yeah.
You know, is a big, big question
really
for a
bizarre.
Lot of people. Well, we're going to see what they make of it this week in Honolulu, because for years, you know, we've heard what could happen along Hawaii's coastlines as the result of climate change. But in Alaska, climate change is already affecting coastal villages. This week in Honolulu, the White House Council on Environmental Quality, NOAA's Office of Coastal Management, the Hawaii and Alaska Sea Grant College programs, the William S. Richardson School of Law, and the Pacific Islands Climate Science Center are all hosting the Symposium on Climate Displacement, Migration, and Relocation. Robin Bronin will be attending. She's the executive director for the Alaska Institute for Justice. We talked earlier. I asked her why the general climate change conversation doesn't seem to include as much about the Arctic changes that are happening twice as quickly in the lower latitudes.
The reason why we are so concerned about what's happening here in the Arctic is because we have seen in the last decade a dramatic decrease of ice and snow, which has a profound impact on the communities that live along the western coast of Alaska, because that Arctic sea ice, which covers the Arctic Ocean, is our natural barrier to the fall storms that come in every year. And even though we don't get hurricanes here in Alaska, we do get hurricane-strength winds. Without that Arctic sea ice to protect communities when the storms come in, they are causing extreme erosion, which is causing the communities to make the decision that they need to relocate their entire community.
With so much exposure, and as you mentioned now, the decision to have to relocate, where are they going, and is there any real help for them in making the move?
That is a really good question. So the focus of my work has been on the fact that in the United States, and in really every other country in the world, we have no governance framework to address this issue of community relocation because of climate change. And so while the Alaska Native communities have been working intensively with state and federal government agencies here in the United States, none of the communities have been able to relocate because there is no government agency that has the mandate or technical assistance or funding to facilitate that relocation. It's meant that the relocations of the three communities that are most imminently threatened, Nutok, Shishmaref, and Kivalina, are moving forward painfully slow.
And they're all there on the western edge of Alaska.
Correct.
So if they're having to move, and yet they see more storm activity coming in, further erosion, and threats to the community, at what point do you see that there will have to be some sort of intervention because of disaster?
That's a really hard question to answer. It's really important to understand that these three communities are indigenous communities that have lived in these locations for millennia. They survive and thrive based on the marine mammals that they hunt and harvest for their food and cultural sustenance. And the other thing that's really important to understand about Alaska is that there are very few roads in our state. So it's actually really similar to the South Pacific. You have vast oceans separating islands. And here in Alaska, we have vast amounts of land separating communities with no roads. For Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Nutok, the only way to get to and from those communities is by small 10-seater planes. So evacuation or relocation is really complicated.
Which seems to mean that people would be forced to take just very little with them to be able to relocate someplace else, and then they'd have to maybe bring in some of those things that they were forced to leave behind. This sounds like a humanitarian crisis. Is it not being viewed that way?
It is a humanitarian crisis, and it's also a human rights issue because, as I was saying, these communities have made the decision that they want to relocate as a community. And so they are looking, and Nutok, for instance, their traditional tribal government, identified a relocation site that is within their traditional subsistence area. They are in a relocation process, but the challenge again is that without that government framework that provides a mandate and funding, it's moving forward very slowly. And the other challenge that has affected these communities is that because they've made the decision to relocate, they are not receiving the funding that they need to maintain the infrastructure within their communities, which is also causing a humanitarian crisis. So none of these communities have running water, plumbed water in their homes.
Was any of the funding ever promised? Was there any expectation that there would be funding?
There was funding that was promised over a decade ago, but because of the complexity of what we're talking about when we're talking about the relocation of entire communities, it's been really unclear which federal or state government should take the lead in regard to facilitating the process. For instance, at each of the relocation sites that the communities have chosen, there are no people living there. There's no infrastructure there. So one of the challenges is figuring out how many different federal and state government agencies need to be involved in building that infrastructure at the relocation site that these communities have chosen in order to protect their traditional lifestyles.
I mean, you seem to be talking about absolutely everything. You can't just pick up a community and plunk it down, but everything from housing to plumbing to being able to have, you know, so maybe some shared community spaces, all of that that defines a community. At this point, with what you see happening around you, is there a path forward?
Yes, and that's why the symposium in Hawaii is so important. The Obama administration has taken this issue very, very seriously. And as you know, President Obama traveled to Alaska last year. And despite his and the federal government's best efforts to quickly try to address these issues, the complexity of it is just making it take much longer than I think anybody anticipated. And the other thing that I want to say, because this always comes up, is the funding issue. And people often think that this is a funding problem because of the cost involved. But it's really important to understand that we don't know how much this is going to cost. And right now, our government at a state and federal level spends billions of dollars responding to extreme weather events like hurricanes, and we need to be way more sophisticated about how those billions of dollars get spent. Because based on the experience that we're having here in Alaska, it's very clear that not only will those extreme weather events continue, but that people living along the coast within the United States, and of course all over the world, are not going to be able to stay where they are. And so if we're more sophisticated about how we use the disaster funding that becomes available after the extreme weather events, we can facilitate a relocation and protect people at the same time.
Robin, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you how you feel about the incoming administration, which, given all the things that we've just talked about, would not necessarily be top of mind.
Well, I'm hopeful. Everybody is affected by extreme weather events. Everybody. If the new administration is concerned about how we respond and protect people from these extreme weather events, then hopefully there'll be an opening through which we can all walk together to respond to the crisis that's currently happening.
Robin Bronin, thank you so much for the time that you gave us this morning, and safe travels.
Thank you very much.
Robin Bronin is a human rights attorney and the executive director for the Alaska Institute for Justice. She's been researching climate-induced relocation of Native Alaskan populations since 2007. This week, she'll be attending the Hawaii Symposium on Climate Displacement, Migration, and Relocation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15. Coming up, Willow and friends bring us the sounds of the holidays, but first, your quiz. When a number of successful musicians come together to form a band, the end result is often referred to as a supergroup. Hawaii has had a couple of those, including this one. The group is a trio consisting of a drummer and percussionist, Noel Okimoto, bass player Dean Taba, and taiko drum master Kenny Endo. Their music is described as a meeting of traditional Japanese taiko and Western improvisational drums with the addition of vibraphone, marimba, Japanese flute, and six-string electric bass. Others have described the group as having a true world music sound with Afro-Cuban, New Orleans, Brazilian swing, odd meter, blues, and Japanese elements all fused with the improvisational spirit of jazz. For today's quiz, we'd like you to tell us the name of this Hawaii-based band. Here's a small hint. The group released a self-titled album 6 years ago, which included the track Gumbo Luau. If you know, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you'll get the HPR prize.
Good morning. I'm Lynn Finnegan from Hawaii Public Charter Schools Network. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Vocalist Willow Chang likes to paint her musical pictures with all the colors in the available spectrum. So her upcoming Christmas program can be expected to offer moods beyond what we might expect. Willow and her musical friends are in her studio to give us a live preview this morning. Good morning, Willow.
Good morning.
I was intrigued by something that was on the description of your concert, was that the moods were extended to include a kind of a melancholy.
Yes, you know, I think that it might be disingenuous to forget that people feel sadness mm-hmm. and saudade, as they say in Portuguese, mm-hmm. Maybe a sense of loss. And that can be a personal feeling, maybe an immediate loss, but it can also be that wondering of where is our world going to? And this year is probably no stranger to that.
There's a fair amount of that
There's
around.
A lot of that. But, yeah. you know, it's a time when we look at conflicts or things that are unresolved or things that we maybe had hoped would go a little differently. And the new year is, you know, quick at hand. And it's a good time to reflect on that. And we don't have as much sunshine, even in Hawaii. And, you know, a lot of these factors contribute to that sense of longing, or maybe you want to be with somebody and you can't be with them. There's an infinite number of reasons to feel that, but why not revel in it?
Sure. Well, for example, the song I'll Be Home for Christmas probably
exactly.
gets a lot of people, yeah.
Or even Happy Christmas, War is Over.
Yeah.
Christmas time is here.
So you've given some thought to this, haven't you?
Yes.
And what kind of different moods are you going to touch on?
Well, we're going to have everything from the sublime to the silly.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they always say you shouldn't try to be all things for everyone, but I think the holidays are inclusive, and that includes the different types of music, the different genres of music. We'll have some things that echo early music, and we'll have swing, and we'll have standards, and we'll have some pop music,
uh-huh.
and some things that maybe people maybe haven't made the association as being holiday, but when they hear them, they'll hear that they're actually quite befitting.
You know, I was thinking about what you're saying about the whole end-of-the-year mood, and it really goes back, irrespective of any one holiday, to a lot of end-of-the-year harvest celebrations
mm-hmm.
and dealing with the onset of winter. I mean, there's a whole sea change that happens to people at the end of the year, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Well, this will be fun. And what are you going to perform this morning?
We're actually going to be doing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, and that's from the film Meet Me in St. Louis.
And your cohorts are?
We've got Dwayne Padilla, the Thriller, on the mandolin, and we have Mr. Ernie Provencher on the bass.
Uh-huh.
And this song was written in 1943, and just want to say one quick little thing, which is when it was first written, they had a lyric which was, "Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow." And when they heard that, they say, "Oh, that's just so depressing. We can't possibly have this in the film. You know, we're right in war-torn,
sure.
Big World War." So they changed it to "Hang a Shining Star on a Silver Bough."
Oh, no kidding.
But in recent years, the first lyric has been making a comeback. So we'll feature both, and you can see which you prefer.
This is from Meet Me in St. Louis. Huh?
Exactly.
That's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. Vincent Minnelli.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. A merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in olden days, golden days of yore. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together. The fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through. somehow and have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Chang and friends will perform Songs of the Season Friday evening at 7:30 p.m. in the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
The American pivot to Asia includes ramping up military presence in the Mariana Islands. But can they survive it? Civil Bee reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, these islands have already felt the impact of World War II activity that's really never been fully cleared. How much additional buildup are we talking about now?
Well, it's enormous, and we're talking specifically about Guam and Saipan and Tinian. Remember, Tinian's the island where the Enola Gay took off to bomb Hiroshima, and then another island called Pagan. And it's enormous in terms of dollar amount, personnel, and so forth. Part of this began back when the U.S. was moving Marines off of Okinawa. Remember that? Okinawa has never been real happy with the large... They do. And we were going to send 8,000 Marines to Guam, but we have since scaled that back. Some of them went to Hawaii, some to Australia. But the expansion of the U.S. military, Marines, Army, Air Force, Navy, in the Mariana area is going to be enormous. And the concerns are, well, they are multiple. One of them is the economic impact. This is an area that relies heavily on tourism. Well, how attractive of a spot would that be for visitors if, in fact, much of the area is used for bombing ranges, sonar training, any number of live fire activities? So it's a very big concern on the part of many people in the island. Having said that, I should point out there are others in the area that welcome the economic opportunities that military expansion will bring.
But you're still talking about some historical sites that may in fact see damage and clearly an environmental threat. What does the EPA say about this, and what does it mean to have a change coming very soon in the heading of the EPA?
Right. There's actually a number of studies that are underway. Some have already been completed. There's no question there's going to be damage to coral reefs. There's concern about affecting whales and dolphins. In one case, there's actually a wildlife refuge that would be used on Guam as a buffer for a training range nearby. And that's kind of shocking. They're looking at building an airfield on Tinian. And so these reports are finding their way. Of course, it's Congress and I suppose the White House ultimately. The Department of the Interior has been preparing a report they're going to send to Obama before he leaves office about the impacts to the Siena Maya, as we call it, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. But will it even matter if the U.S. military gets its way? Congress has control. This is technically a part of the United States.
So, Chad, though, is there any word about what President-elect Donald Trump feels about building up military force in the Marianas?
You know, he actually said while campaigning that he would pay attention to the islands out there and make sure that they have support. As you know, Donald Trump is a big question mark in so many ways, but he definitely has been in support of expanding the military. I should also add quickly that China is another concern in the area. As you know, they've been building artificial islands in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. So this could potentially be a conflict, to say nothing of North Korea. So this is definitely a pivot to a military Asia-Pacific region.
And something that's going to take a lot of our attention as we go forward. Thank you, Chad. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. In America and China, one group is asking whether business ethics can be the foundation for peace. This comes as several American companies are cutting back their expansion into China or divesting their holdings altogether to newly flush Chinese companies. But to Zhaofeng Zhou North, the idea that business ethics can pave the way to peace is a concept worth exploring. She's the co-founder of the Zhou Enlai Peace Institute, a nonprofit educational effort based in Beijing and Honolulu. This week, it'll be hosting a discussion at Chaminade University as part of a series of events celebrating her great uncle, the first premier of modern China, Zhou Enlai. Thank you so much for coming in. Good
Thank
to see
you. Thank you for having me.
Business ethics and corporate culture in the United States and China are often seen as very different.
Yes.
With those kinds of differences, how do you find a place of common ground to be able to discuss how they impact a peaceful relationship going forward?
Well, I thought about that, you know, how different between China and America. But there's one common we all have is you know, all business is people's business, regardless you're Chinese or America or England, wherever you're from. So without, and the people's business, the most important is relationship. So without the relationship, there is no business. So all the people make it happen.
That person-to-person relationship building that happens perhaps at a different level than what happens within a government can sometimes be at odds with what's happening governmentally. How do you begin to move what happens in the corporate structure or within a business ethics structure and move that into a relationship with a government?
Well, all business has its own core, and that's all come from the human heart, you know, when you go into the source, and there is no difference between, you know, we may have a different cultural, different background and experience, but for the core, that's where we're coming at the same source, which is the human heart, which it has love, respect, you know, learning it from each other, and collaboration. So this is the words that really resonate to everyone.
For a long time, we kind of felt like the world was getting smaller. There were lots of American companies moving into China. Mm-hmm. But now we see a pullback. You know, McDonald's and Coca-Cola and several other companies that have decided that they're not going to maintain a presence there as an American company anymore. They're selling their interests. Not so much Starbucks. They're going to stay there. But when you have those companies seeing that maybe it's not so right for them to be in China anymore, they've just sort of, you know, gone through the arc of whatever they could get from being in China, isn't that a sign that maybe American companies and the way in which we do business is not necessarily as compatible with the way business is being done in China, or that there might be a perceived threat?
Yeah, you know, the both countries are growing. Well, they, you know, the products they have, for instance, in McDonald's, I think they were in China in early 80s. And that was new, and lots of Chinese, it attracted lots of young people. But from time to time, people still, you know, the most important is the health in China, because the pollution and the disease and the food is, we are what we eat. And they are very aware, and also through the economic in China, everybody got a little money, and they have more aware for what they eat, more healthy food. So actually, as you know, even in America, we don't like so much of a greasy food. The environment has changed, and the product, if it's still the 80s and now it's the 21st century, maybe it's need a growth for, you know, for the food industry as well.
So you see more of the pullback of those kinds of companies as being a response to greater health awareness, not necessarily because the business climate is not favorable for them to be operating in China.
Yeah, we have a lot of American food, let's say Subway. People love that. I just came back from China. I lived there for 6 months. And Subway has been very popular. You know, we pretty much eat at least one or twice a week.
So forgetting the companies for a second that are moving away from China, the ones mm-hmm. that are still there, where do you see the most cross-pollination in terms of business ethics and moving toward a peaceful world and a peaceful relationship in the interdependency that we've been told for such a long time is what may well see us through?
Well, mostly it's a collaboration and a respect. When you're in a different country, you learn their culture, you learn their ethics, and understand what people actually, you know, what they're truly needs. Because the cultural differences, and the most of the company I've seen are still there. They've been there for over 30 years. It is because they has been, you know, the company has been have been grown into that cultural, and they build really strong relationship, and they need one another.
Which companies would they be?
For instance, the Citibank, Huaqi Bank. It's first opened in early 80s, and they're still there. I have a friend that working in China. They are still they're working for hotels and trading company.
But forgive me, when you're talking about the financial sector, a lot of people were going to be saying, wait a minute, how could you possibly talk about business ethics when we saw what happened with the, you know, implosion of the financial industry not all that long ago in America and what it caused worldwide?
Yeah. So there, you know, business also been through a lot of change because the it's, you know, we are smaller. The world is we have to working as one with understanding and respect. And those are very important for the people, especially crossing country.
Well, thank you for coming in, spending a little time with us as you're about to go off and launch a few more activities today. Thank
yes.
you for being here with us today.
Yeah.
Zhafang Zhou North is an executive with Asia Pacific Group and the co-founder of the Honolulu and Beijing-based nonprofit, the Zhou Enlai Peace Institute. She connects people in America and China through business partnerships and cultural exchanges and special events, including the Business Ethics event tomorrow at Chaminade. She's also producing the documentary Footsteps, tracing the rise of her great uncle, the first premier of modern China, Zhou Enlai.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. In the year 2000, the Hawaii Community Foundation became a statewide entity serving, in addition to Oahu, Hawaii Island, Maui County, and Kauai. The North Kauai Community Fund was created by local people to support community projects on the Garden Isle. They helped Aloha School Early Learning Center by funding a curriculum planning day for faculty, ukulele lessons, and improved the school garden program. Listening centers were built. Here, students read and listen to music, and we all know how important music is to children's brain development. Perhaps best of all, it offered financial aid for families in need. Malama Kauai is another group assisted by the fund. This community garden program has 42 plots. The fund helped them purchase tools needed to provide an environment for teaching people how to grow their own food. After going through the Malama Kauai program, many used their knowledge to start home gardens. This is an example of philanthropy working at the grassroots level. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, as we age, we start to feel more and more joint pain, and of course, we start thinking about arthritis. Is it necessarily arthritis?
Well, in a lot of cases, it can be. You know, arthritis is just wear and tear on our joints, and that happens as we get older. But we're going to talk today about some things we can do to prevent the feeling of pain and discomfort when we first get out of bed in the morning. And then also, what are some of the steps and strategies that we can use when we do have arthritis? Are there new techniques or new treatments out there on the horizon, and who might benefit from those?
Do some of these techniques involve exercise or stretch? Or, you know, calisthenics that one can do?
Well, and that's the basics when you have the condition. But when it gets to the point where it's causing you chronic pain or you're not really able to do any of the exercises because of the symptoms of arthritis,
yeah,
then there are some new things that we're doing in medicine that we're going to talk about today, sometimes even injections to joint areas with things that are different than what we were used to that can really help preserve our function.
So there's some medications out there as well.
We'll talk about them today.
Great. Thanks, Kathy. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Aloha, I'm Deborah Halbert, a rock climber from Oahu. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Stargazer time, our weekly feature where we see what to look for in our dark island skies, as well as find out little bits of information about what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we're welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here.
So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars towards the west after sunset. The moon this week will begin to wane as the week goes on.
And I understand you've got an update on a final stage of a NASA mission.
Yes, it is NASA's Cassini mission to Saturn, and it is about to end in dramatic fashion. The Cassini probe, which has been studying Saturn since the turn of the century, is conducting a series of suicidal orbits that will see the probe dash through the rings of Saturn, make close encounters with its moon, and then end in a fiery display of molten metal as the probe burns up in the Saturnian atmosphere.
Are they going to be streaming this thing live on the internet that we can watch it, or is this going to be kind of time delayed?
Unfortunately, yes. Because of the time delay between here and Saturn, it's not something you can live stream, but we will be receiving images up until Cassini's final moments.
And I'm guessing that we're going to be learning some pretty important information before this thing finally calls it a day.
You can bet it. Cassini's final orbits will take into places that no spacecraft has been before. This intrepid robotic explorer will be uniquely placed to gather incredible data and images that will give us the best view of the giant planet yet.
What's the closest it'll get to Saturn and still be feeding images back to us?
Well, that's really hard to tell. As we get closer to Saturn, there's an intense radiation environment, and it's entirely possible that this could interfere with the communication systems on the probe. So we're hoping that at least we'll get some close-up images of the upper atmosphere.
Should be pretty cool.
Should be awesome.
And again, I know we've talked about similar stuff relating to this before, but why are they sending it into the atmosphere as opposed to ditching it elsewhere?
Well, unfortunately, Cassini lacks enough fuel and power to make a hard burn for anywhere else in the solar system. Its nuclear battery is still pretty good, but the rest of the spacecraft is aging badly. It is taking a beating from the brutal radiation environment around Saturn. So even if we could send it somewhere else, it might not survive the trip.
Well, let's hope we get some nice pictures and possibly some video in this final stages of the mission. We appreciate the update. Thank you, Christopher Phillips.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week here on Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Earlier in the show, we looked at a musical supergroup. That's what happens when popular and highly skilled musicians come together from their own other groups to collaborate. Hawaii's been home to several of these over the years, and for today's Backyard Quiz, we put our spotlight on one of them. It's made up of drummer and percussionist Noel Okimoto, bassist Dean Taba, and taiko drum master Kenny Endo. Their music is a blend of traditional Japanese taiko with Western improvisational jazz drumming, with the addition of vibraphone, marimba, Japanese flute, and six-string electric bass. The group is said to create a true world music sound, influenced by Afro-Cuban, New Orleans, Brazilian, swing, odd meter music, blues, and Japanese musical styles. For today's quiz, we asked you for the name of this Hawaii-based supergroup, and as a hint, we told you the group released a self-titled album in 2010 that included the track Gombo Luau. If you can name any of the other tracks on that album, you probably already know that the group is Rhythm Summit, and nobody got that today, so the prize stays where it is, but at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The Queen Emma Summer Palace is home to more than a century of tradition, a tradition it celebrates by opening its doors to the public two evenings a year, the next one being this Friday. It's an opportunity to take in one of Hawaii's historic treasures, all lit up for the holidays. And Mahea Bernal is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Mahea.
Good morning, Chris. Mele kalikimaka.
Yes, indeed. And are you all, is the palace all decked out for this occasion?
The palace is, we have touches of Christmas in each room of the museum, and It looks beautiful.
I imagine it does. And this is kind of a new tradition you're establishing. How long have you been doing this?
This is our third year. We started in 2014, And we've opened the palace two nights a year during the month of December to celebrate the Holy Festival of Christmas as Kamehameha III considered it to be.
Well, and part of this is talking about how Christmas came to Hawaii. What's the background to that?
Well, Christmas came to Hawaii back in the 1700s, and it was in 1786, Captain George Dixon, he was a British captain, and he and his ship, the Charlotte, were docked at Waimea Bay, Kauai. Remembering Christmas back in England, he actually celebrated Christmas on his ship with his crew. And about 50 years later, during the reign of Kamehameha III, Christmas was only celebrated in the Hawaiian kingdom if it fell on the Sabbath, and that was twice. And so otherwise, Christmas in a Christian kingdom, it was a day that passed unnoticed and government offices and businesses remained open. The missionaries celebrated Christmas among themselves. And then several years later, when Kamehameha IV visited England at the age of 15, he saw what he considered the great festival of Christmas. Mm-hmm. And when he became the king, he set aside December 25th, 1856, as a national day of thanksgiving in the Hawaiian kingdom. So he had not stepped into making a proclamation yet until he was confirmed to the Anglican Church in the year 1862, uh-huh. And then he made a national proclamation that Christmas should be observed, and that was December of 1862.
That's just one of those, kind of fascinating footnotes to history that we must get a lot of that there.
Yes, we do. In fact, you know, many people, when they come and they ask us, do you celebrate Christmas here? And so we tell them, yes, we do, because we point out it was this king, Kamehameha IV, the husband of Queen Emma, who made that proclamation and celebrated with Christmas Eve's church service at the Cathedral Basilica of Our Lady of Peace, downtown Honolulu, and also carrying a celebration over at Iolani Palace. And so when they hear that story, they begin to understand and realize, wow, Christmas in Hawaii started a century ago.
Yeah. Well, and in doing so, Mahea, you bring people into the museum that probably have never been there before. Have you been getting a lot of visitor, outside of Hawaii, visitor traffic?
We have. We've been getting many Malihini coming, but also Kama'aina, who drive by every day, and they have never been here before. They see the banner that's out on the highway, the Pali Highway, mm-hmm. At the front entrance to Queen Emma Summer Palace, and they decide, hey, I want to check that out. And so on Saturday night, we had several Kama'aina as well as Malihini who came for the first time, and they said they've never heard of Queen Emma Summer Palace, but they, saw the banner passing by, and they wanted to just come in and check it out and find out what we're doing.
How about mainland visitors? People outside of Hawaii, do they know much about the Summer Palace? Do you get many of them?
We do. As a matter of fact, we have many visitors from outside of Hawaii who call us and to, ask us, what our hours of operation is, where we're located, because they've read about us in Frommer's, the travel magazines. Uh-huh. They've visited our website, Daughters of Hawaii, or they have visited Iolani Palace and they were notified about Queen Emma Summer Palace here through their visit at Iolani Palace. And so they stop over as well, and they want to see both places.
It has seemed to me, Mahea, that there's been a growing interest on the part of mainland visitors in history, not just the usual tourist stuff, but in finding out a little bit more about the place they're visiting. Does that seem that way to you?
Yes, it is. It is becoming that. Many of the visitors coming into Hawaii are known as the heritage tourist, and they're looking for cultural sites, cultural experiences, and they're wanting to come to these places because they want to expand their knowledge, gain awareness of Hawaiian culture and its role in history. So they're looking for that authenticity when they come to a cultural site such as Queen Emma Summer Palace, and to walk, you know, in this home where the people, you know, who were of historic significance, Queen Emma and her husband Kamehameha IV, lived, and to experience what they lived here, and to hear the stories of their lives.
And of course, your setting is kind of an ideal one, especially at this time of the year when it's getting a little cooler, isn't it? You can see why it was built there.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when we come in very early in the morning, it's cold. You can see the mist just hovering, you know, right at the tops of the mountains. And sometimes it's raining. We've actually had a lot of rain here over the past several weeks. But it feels wintry here in Nu'uanu Valley. And so it's a perfect setting for the Christmas holidays.
Sure. All the more reason to celebrate when you feel that little bit of a chill in the air. Thanks
yes.
so much for talking with us, Mahea.
Thank you, Chris.
The Queen Emma Summer Palace will open its doors to the public Saturday evening at 6 p.m. for a Christmas celebration, and details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Then I have a correction to make. That's Saturday evening that the Queen Emma Summer Palace will open its doors. But that's a kind of a very traditional way to celebrate Christmas. I'm looking at the way it's celebrated here in Hawaii.
They've only been doing it for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
But and it's only available for a few nights every week. But a beautiful way to be able to step back in history a little bit and also to maybe get a little peace from the present.
Yeah. I hadn't heard that term before, the heritage tourist. But, you know, it's taken for granted when you go to Europe that you're going to be a kind of heritage tourist. And yet Hawaii tourism hasn't always been framed that way. I think it's all to the good to look at that.
Well, you just might be right about that. But for a lot of people who come here and they see some of the sites, including Iolani Palace, and walk away with a completely different idea of what Hawaii is all about, that part seems to be very, very important to a lot of people, and glad to see it. And the Summer Palace is so beautiful.
Well, there's no place quite like it.
Like home?
No place like home. That's right.
If it's the Summer Palace, for sure. That's going to do it for us for on this Monday morning. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about wellhead protection with the Sierra Club Maui Community Board member and a member of the Maui County Board of Water Supply. Lucien Dene will join us.
And we'll have a Nutcracker performance coming up that's specially adapted to Hawaii and its history.
We'd like to hear from you, and you can always reach us anytime you like on our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217. Please be sure to leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. And if you'd like us to reach you, be sure to leave your phone number, too. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of the show or want to pass one, you can find them on the Conversation page under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of the Conversation.